You're listening to Ash FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. This is the AFM News Hour, and I'm news team correspondent Gary Leonard. And I'm joined in the studio today with the one and only David Forbes. David, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
David, so we have certainly a good amount to talk about.
Yes.
And we are going to speak about the March 26th City Council meeting. However, I think we'd be remiss before talking about agenda items and presentations and hotels is talking about the water crisis that took place right here in Asheville. So what happened? What's going on?
So it's interesting because generally this has been such a massive communications failure on the city of Asheville's part that, you know, the press has really had to step in and inform people. So on Sunday night, a city contractor or someone contracting with the city water system, which covers about 100,000 customers, includes businesses, households, et cetera, in and around the city of Asheville, was making a repair. The repair was made. This was the Lyman Street area, which runs right between South Side and the use of city's turn, the River Arts District, like right between. So they initially, some people along Lyman Street were advised, you know, apparently, you know, five or so properties, which some of those properties could well include people that, you know, buildings have a lot of people in them, but depending on which part of Lyman Street, but we're set, advised, look, you're going to have to, you know, you boil your water until we're done with this repair. The next morning, the city did say that they found out that the equipment had busted some of the equipment, they called it equipment failure, busted on this water line, and apparently it was a big enough water line that affected a large area. Initially, they just said, it's still Lyman Street. The people who were supposed to boil their water before, and the city would say the boil water advisory isn't a boil water notice. And it's kind of like the difference between a watch and a storm warning. Boil water advisory means there has been some contact, there has been some sort of issue. The water may be totally fine, but as precaution, boil it for 1 to 3 minutes first before you use it. Nonetheless, it's kind of the sort of thing people should be informed about, whereas a notice is like, you have to. We've detected some crud. So I actually had heard about this, and I called the city water services as a resident that about around midday on Monday, and I was told, oh, Lyman Street's the only area that needs to worry. It turned out that was not the case. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, even the city's first press release, which happened a few hours before I called water services, said, quote, a large area has been impacted.
That.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they interestingly, throughout all of this, the city has a system called AVL Alerts, and it was supposed to reach every number in the phone book, every water customer, and then and granted, that has some limitations because a lot of people rent. They don't pay their water bill directly. They pay to the landlords, include their rent, you know, most of the city rents. So, and anyone, you know, renters or not, who landlords or not, who was signed up for AVL Alerts. So on Monday night, however, I start hearing from readers, from locals, hey, we're not informed. And at first, it's some renters. I count a lot of people, you know, in the Meadows apartments, for example. It's a large, mostly working class kind of resident complex in West Asheville, saying, look, yeah, we didn't know that if we turned our water on this morning and it didn't come out, we were supposed to boil it later if it finally did start coming out. We had no idea. And so I did a post about this on Tuesday. And it's to kind of give the listeners an idea of how intrepid journalist, I guess, I don't even know that intrepid, tries to trace this mess, literally, and tries to inform people. And I said, look, if your water went out at all yesterday, you got to boil it. If it didn't go out at all, then you're probably fine. Now, fine being a relative term because the city had another break.
Yep.
A week, just less than a week before, up near its reservoir, the North Fork Reservoir, and that sent sediment all throughout the system. We've all had to deal with that. I think a lot of us have in some way. And they've been claiming the water is safe to drink, but I've been hearing people who have consumed it, including the city's apparently received at least one report, have said it was actually they felt sick afterwards. Not like drastically sick, but their stomach was upset.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's definitely some concern over that. So we were already kind of dealing with one water thing, then this thing happens. The city claims they had no idea of the exact area impacted by this water line. The water line hit on Monday. But it turned out to be thousands and thousands of people, at least. A lot of them in West Asheville and around the River District, but and around South Side. But some other areas as well. The city claimed because of topography, they didn't have a clear idea. At the same time, going over 24 hours later, no alert had been sent out. None. Even some, we started hearing people who were also property owners, who even people who had gone earlier and specifically signed up for the city service, you know, sometimes years before. Mm-hmm. Nothing. They'd heard nothing. And so city held a press briefing on Tuesday. They said they were lifting the boil water advisory except for two very small areas, still in Lyman and near Warren Wilson. But they didn't really have many clear answers. Like, even at that point, an alert had still not been sent out. They said, we're going to change our communication guidelines. You know, from now on, if we have a big break like this, we're going to assume, you know, alert as many people as possible. If your water doesn't come out of the tap, you got to boil it. But they didn't. I even came out after the meeting and grabbed a cup of tea downtown while I was kind of composing the story, kind of going through some documents. The person, the worker there who was making the tea was like, I signed up for the city's alert service. I never heard of it.
Yeah.
I've been encountering that again and again and again. Still no alert, according to a lot of people I've talked to, was sent out even by yesterday. And a lot of people are kind of left in the dark. So what we have here, and I got to say it bluntly, you know, maybe in the first hour or two when they didn't have a real realization of how big the issue was, though it seems like the technical knowledge that a big line having an equipment failure would lead to a lot of people being affected is kind of something the city water system should know and mm-hmm. then be able to communicate to all the city departments. Mm-hmm. But these apparently this alert system can be triggered by any number of city officials for obvious reasons, you know, because these alerts can take any number of different forms. Multiple departments, people in multiple departments can issue them, which kind of makes this failure even more baffling. Mm. But then as the day wore on Monday, and it was clear that thousands and thousands of people were affected. And then especially as, you know, Monday turned into Tuesday, why not issue a blanket alert? And heck, later on Tuesday, why issue an alert? This has been lifted. For more information, contact so-and-so. The brownish water should be gone by Friday. They also said that there. Yeah. So this isn't just – this is beyond a mistake. This is incompetence. And I think we just have to say that. This is absolute complete communications failure from the city. And, you know, okay, this time the water from that bowl of water advisory might have been fine. The city claims they haven't detected any bacteria or anything, and they've been testing it. But if they failed this badly, we have real questions that we have to ask about what if it's a catastrophe next time? What if it is a break that puts, you know, thousands and thousands of people's lives at stake?
I was going to ask that, actually, yeah. David, is that when we're dealing with something that impacts such a large number of citizens here in Asheville,
yeah.
a public utilities issue, have you seen anything, something like this, in terms of your history of covering local politics, of the city of Asheville's ability or inability to be able to communicate and disseminate information to this scale?
So the city water system generally hasn't been, you know, its infrastructure is ancient like a lot of the rest of the city is. But since the city took control in 05, there haven't been that many breaks. To the city's credit, they, for a while, it was regarded as kind of the jewel of the city's infrastructure compared to the other stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, it was aging. It has its issues. But the city had started investing, you know, as soon as it took control, investing very seriously in some upgrades and improvements. And process is obviously still ongoing. But we have real questions now about, you know, is there an issue with this contractor? Was there the earlier line, which apparently, you know, was yeah. there an issue? Does the city need more personnel? Does it need more with a certain area of expertise? Should we be focusing less on, like, running up the budget for the police department or more raises for senior city staff again, when maybe what we need to do is have, you know, more equipment and more mm-hmm. people in-house, rank and file in the water department? Maybe that's what needs to happen. At the very least, we need to be asking these questions now. We really need to be investigating it. So it's interesting. Some of the people who had received notices last week about the issue with the discolored water still hadn't received notices about this potentially as bad issue. Mm-hmm. So clearly the city has the capability to notify people. They didn't use it in this situation. That said, though, I mean, as a journalist, I found the city's communications, with some notable exceptions, completely lacking. Mm. They don't take the need to communicate with the public nearly seriously enough. They often don't plan, especially for communities where people aren't property owners, don't have landlines. A lot of their planning's out of date. They've improved that somewhat, but only under a lot of pressure. And here, they did have a system that could contact a lot of people kind of outside of that usual kind of network, and then you use it. Mm-hmm. So I think you just have a competence issue at some point. You have to ask, like, you know, why did they fail this badly on something that seems a pretty obvious step? especially by the point when the public was, you know, rightly pretty mad about
it. And so before we move on to the city council meeting, a couple of things come up for me, David, is that one, you know, water, we all know how important water is. Water is life. And it's a reminder for me as folks have been kind of I know that my employer, we didn't have water for a while and we've all been bringing bottled water in. But like Flint, Michigan, you know, those folks still don't have clean water. And then I guess like
certainly that's and Flint is a magnitude of severity. 100%.
But a reminder of the essential basic quality of life that is water that, you know, sometimes we take for granted and how important it is to be able to communicate the issues if they are issues around it. And the second thing that comes up for me, David, is there was a press conference, right? I don't know how
a press briefing.
I don't know how what kind of precedent is typically set around those, but were they able to alleviate any of like the other like kind of internal issues or in terms of outside of speaking to what was going on for the public? Were there any of the things of why this may have happened the way that it did?
We haven't heard any major updates. I mean, obviously, and people can, the city has this up on their website. So myself and some bunch of other reporters, you know, kind of rightly kind of took them to task and, you know, kind of try to drill down on why was this communications failure so vast. And you have apologies from city manager Deborah Campbell, assistant manager Kathy Ball, water director David Melton, communications director Dawa Hitch. So you had, you know, them saying, look, we've learned, we'll do better. But people still haven't received an alert. Yeah. Like there's this very basic step they could have taken. They never took it. And so there's they admitted that their, you know, issues were kind of muddled. Their approach was kind of muddled to this. But we don't see a lot of movement in the other direction. So, frankly, I mean, they claim the communication issue has been alleviated. I think I speak for a lot of Asheville-ians. I'll believe it when I see it. In the meantime, the main piece up in the Blade right now, aptly titled Clear as Mud, delves into delves into all these issues and kind of gives a little more of a breakdown for listeners that might be interested.
Clear as sediment.
It clears mud's a little pit, but yeah, it's a little bit of gallows humor there for those of us who've been wondering if our water's been safe to drink for a week.
Indeed. Well, David, let's go ahead and move on to that March 26th city council meeting. There were some definitely hot button issues that came up, and it seems like every time that you and I sit down to do a city council report, we're talking about and certainly the March 26th meeting was no different. And so there was a conversation regarding a 56 room hotel of a 5-story building, and there was some discussion around that. For the listeners, can you set a little context in terms of the hotel and the vote?
So this hotel was one of the two. There were three hotels that came up during, well, I guess we're kind of tentatively calling council's hotel freeze now, which, you know, started last October and kind of thawed, as it were, at the council meeting before this was the earliest council meeting in March. And initially, this marked the return of one of those hotels that got delayed during that. There was a previous hotel, very controversial, that passed at the previous meeting before this. And initially, in October, it looked like that hotel wouldn't pass. The developer had pulled it. Now they brought it back at the first meeting in March. It passed very narrowly, 4-3, very controversial. Then this hotel, which was also delayed during that period where it was clear council was just generally adamantly against hotels, came back. This one, one of the developers is Albert Sneed, major local real estate kind of mogul, property owner. One of the neighboring properties is condos, which Sneed has also built. Sneed is apparently, according to a number of himself, his representatives, a number of council members, involved in developing some affordable housing with Mountain Housing Opportunities. And that fact was used repeatedly by people in favor of this hotel. It's kind of a weird rationale, but, you know, that's basically saying, look, well, we're building affordable housing elsewhere, so we're not like some of the other hoteliers. The other thing they touted was that this project was preserving historic homes. These homes are under a historic preservation easement. This developer put them under that, and that basically they'll have, you know, some larger hotel type buildings, but they'll have lodging rooms out of these historic structures. And that, and this is an argument we're seeing a lot from developers of hotels now, is, oh, turning into a hotel will allow us to renovate this thing. Critics of hotels don't really seem to buy this very much. They don't really they don't really see much use in, you know, fancy, in their view, fancy historic buildings that no one in the public in Asheville really gets to use that are reserved for tourists coming in. Kind of removes them from the public life. Also, more than, you know, one critic has pointed out, you can totally develop it as something else, even residential housing, and find a way to make the money to renovate it. You know, luxury hotel is not the only option at the table. You're going to make a lot of money off this. There's clearly like just straight more profit motive going on there, and there's some accuracy there, I think. So this came forward. It, again, you saw it only passed by a single vote. Interesting back and forth. But you're seeing kind of the lines on council around this. At least the votes keep going in this direction. Kind of harden a little bit. Once again, interestingly, Brian Haynes, one of the more left-leaning council members as far as Asheville goes, voted against it. And we actually, the Blade's recently been delving into the history of the city approving hotels during this council. Mm-hmm. And he's actually been one of the only members that's been against just about every hotel that's come up. And he actually kind of summed up the opposition to hotels and said, look, we have another hotel right next to where we approved a hotel last meeting. He'd vote against that hotel, but council as a whole approved it. You know, we're looking at more hotels coming down the pike. And again, it's a high-end hotel. We don't really need more of this. But at the end of his remarks, said, look, people are getting pushed out more and more and more, and they don't see us doing a lot to stop it.
Yeah.
And that definitely kind of sums up the complaint of kind of more the anti-gentrification side. You also, Gwen Whistler, who is a fairly one of council's most conservative members, but has been voting against a lot of hotels lately. That's not always been the case. She has voted for hotels before. But in the last hotel, in this one, she said that she thinks that there's downtown has basically reached a saturation point. You know, there's too many coming into downtown. We need other stuff there to keep kind of a more economically diverse area. So she voted against it. And then where votes kind of switched from last time was Councilmember Shanika Smith, who controversially voted for the previous hotel, said, look, we just approved a hotel down the street from this one. We don't need more of this. I don't really see this as putting a whole lot back in the community. I'm voting against it. So she voted against it. But then Councilor Keith Young, who voted against the previous hotel in March, said, look, the developer's building affordable housing elsewhere. That's good enough for me, and voted for it. And that seemed to be what a lot of it revolved around. Kapoor, Councilmember Vijay Kapoor and Julie Mayfield, who have generally voted more for hotels than not. There's been so few exceptions, but in general, they've been in favor of them. Both, you know, they cited the historic preservation. That was a big selling point for them. For Young, it was the fact the developers building affordable housing elsewhere. But interestingly, you know, there's not a proposal before council to pass affordable housing yet by this developer. It's kind of – so both with this and with Mayor Manheimer saying last meeting that she was more inclined to vote for hotels now that the Tourism Development Authority, which runs the hotel tax but is mostly – its board is hoteliers largely, or people from the hotel industry, that since they'll study the impact of tourism on Asheville, she's now more okay since that study's being done of voting for it. Neither of those are concrete promises. You know, this person isn't putting in writing, yeah, I'm bringing forward this, you know, this housing. It's a project they're considering and they're exploring and they're, you know, moving forward a little bit, but it's not like it's on the table for council to vote. There's no condition requiring that. And then, you know, the TDA might study something at some point. So it seems like for at least some on council, the promises don't have to be that material for them to vote for a hotel. And I think that sets up a really interesting political battle going forward.
Absolutely. And there seems to be such like a loose precedent in terms of the inconsistency of those who are voting for and those who are voting against, and kind of the criterias and very loose criterias in which certain stipulations, such as a commitment to, you know, X amount of affordable housing units, like a commitment towards, you know, whether it be any sort of like living wage. Yeah. Like those are the things that seem to kind of win over votes, right? And it just seems to be this precedent that continues to happen in terms of these hotels coming in, where more or less we're seeing these 4-3 votes, but I'm not seeing a lot of 4-3 votes in the opposite way, right? Where like hotels don't happen. More or less they typically get approved.
There has been one in the entirety of the current council that was straight up voted down.
Yeah.
It was interesting, it was actually voted down 6-1. Mm-hmm. In that case, Whistler was who was generally voted against the more recent batch of hotels, was the sole vote, you know, in favor of approving it.
Yeah.
Or was the sole vote against voting it down.
Sure.
You know, she said it could be modified, maybe improved a little bit. So I think that's a good point. There really aren't consistent politics on this. The council members who've been consistent on this are fairly few. Haynes is the main one who has overwhelmingly voted against hotels.
Right.
But the other ones are all over the map.
Yeah.
Some of them, you know, Kapoor, Mayfield, even Mannheimer to some extent.
They've been consistent.
Generally, you know, they generally side with hotels, but even then there's been some exceptions.
Right.
You know, Kapoor has voted against hotels before, so is Mayfield, so is Mannheimer. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting to kind of see this. But then you have, you know, Young and Smith, whose votes have crisscrossed pretty repeatedly on, you know, oh, I'm voting for it this time because I think it is going to be good for the community. Oh, I'm not voting for it this time. I don't think it will. Mm. So really the politics for all of council on this are pretty much all over the map. And I think it does speak to the fact that there's a lot of anti kind of gentrification anger out there. And heck, this might end up doing it. You haven't really seen a lot of that opposition solidify as much.
Right.
Notably, the freeze, as it were, for council voting for hotels happened after you had locals show up 50, 60, and 70 strong to developer meetings, are usually the very first stage of a development process. Hardly anyone except a few property owners usually shows up to those. And getting really angry. And I think we might see that happen again because coming down the pike, as a matter of fact, going for the Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday is the proposal to turn the Flatiron Building, which is site to over 80 local, you know, organizations and some very like local small businesses in there, turn that into a hotel. And that project has been kind of a lightning rod because it's one of the last spaces in downtown there's remotely affordable office organizational space.
Right.
You have a lot of like kind of ground level nonprofits or, you know, a lot of small proprietors, you know, people who may like have a business, but it operates out of like a single small office who will be kicked out. They're not offering any parking. Parking would also all be foisted on the city decks. So like, and that proposal almost like people got fairly understandably outraged about that.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out.
Fascinating.
But that one, which is kind of this lightning rod for public rage, is coming back up again.
Sure.
So I think it'll be interesting to see, is that going to be where council draws the line and says, no, we won't do this?
Right.
Or is it going to be that they're, nope, it's 4-3 again or 5-2, they're okay with it.
Yeah.
So but I think if that happened, you would see kind of the floodgates open public anger-wise. People are outraged about this.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned for that discussion. Well, we spoke a little bit about affordable housing, and something that has been kind of at the tip of a lot of folks' mind, and even tongue, has been the development and redevelopment of Lee Walker Heights.
Yeah, city's oldest public housing complex.
Correct. And kind of with various proposals and drafts and where things stand on that. And there was a discussion regarding the city manager and a potential grant with HACA, which is
the
Housing Authority of City of Asheville. What's going on with Lee Walker Heights,
so,
David?
Lee Walker Heights has been – the city's tried to redevelop it for many years. The city's idea is that all the residents who are already there get to, you know, still stay there.
Mm-hmm.
They get updated units. The place is old, and public housing throughout the U.S. and Asheville is not just certainly no exception, but a glaring example, has not been well maintained. So they come back to refurbish units, more community space, more green space, modern housing. But it also becomes mixed use, so you have a range of people from new incomes and different backgrounds living there. Turning public housing into mixed use is, to put it mildly, a complicated issue.
Yeah, 100%.
There are countries where public housing has worked, largely I'll mention due to having left-wing or outright socialist governments, because it is mixed income. You have everyone from, like, the president of a business to, like, you know, someone who may be unemployed living under the same roof.
Sure.
And it's been like that since, you know, in some cases since the 20s and 30s. And that has generally led to stuff being more maintained, you know, having broad cross sections of communities there. The U.S. has not had that experience. Public housing, often paired with redlining and with the devastation of urban renewal, has often been used here as a way to further segregation, not to break it down.
Mm-hmm.
So in some areas, plans to turn public housing into mixed use have largely resulted in the current residents, generally working class, dealing with more limited income, overwhelmingly African American,
displacement,
getting kicked out, and then the mixed use ends up being replaced with more affluent, usually whiter residents.
Sure,
that's a real concern.
Colonialism.
Exactly. At the same time, I think everyone's generally kind of acknowledged that the buildings need to be refurbished. Something needs to happen there. Federal law does limit, means that if someone is living there in good standing with the housing authority, they have to be let back.
Mm-hmm.
Or they have to be given a voucher to get housing somewhere else, which can be daunting. Or they have to be given housing somewhere else in public housing while these new units are being built and then be given their spot back. However, in practice, we've seen, you know, there's I did a story for Carolina Public Press a number of years ago on the way that evictions, there were these spikes in evictions that weren't always explained. People get evicted for public housing for, in some cases, for incredibly arbitrary reasons. And public housing, the housing authority couldn't explain why these sudden spikes would happen. Activists within public housing and residents have asserted that sometimes that's a way of, if someone gets cleared out by an eviction or is facing that, they don't get their unit back. Mm-hmm. And so that can sometimes be a way of you know, clearing out the existing residents in favor of whiter, wealthier residents. We're not sure if that's happening here yet.
Yeah.
But that's a real concern looming all over all this. So I think the situation with Lee Walker, especially since the city is looking to see if this can serve as a model for redeveloping right. aging public housing around town, which way it goes. Yeah. You know, is this a way of like updating this for a new generation while still keeping current residents kind of in there? Certainly there was a lot of pressure that led to Lee Walker residents being more involved than was originally planned in mm-hmm. kind of planning out this process. But what's going to be the result of that? That's really where the proof is going to come down. When this is built, will the residents that have been there for many years and their families and their communities still have a place there, or won't they?
I think there are a lot of eyes on how yes. this plays out. This
exactly.
feels like a very crucial and a crux yeah. in terms of where we are
I
as
agree.
A city, in terms of who we're prioritizing
yeah.
And kind of the overall trajectory. That is, you know, quite frankly, as we alluded to, displacement and disenfranchisement
yeah.
in terms of like who's getting pushed out and who's being prioritized. So,
yeah.
And David, I know you've written plenty of pieces regarding affordable housing.
Yeah.
And for the listeners out there, we've talked about some issues and you're obviously able to speak to them so brilliantly, mm-hmm. but
no,
there's
thank
so
you.
Much context to it. And where can listeners go to find out more information about that?
AshevilleBlade.com.
All right, David. Well, thank you so much as always for joining us here on the Asheville FM NewsHour.
Always a pleasure.